Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we visit with Liz Freema. Back once again in the studio with me. She provides concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hoe. And as a matter of fact, she has clients in many other states and some of them quite a ways away. And she knows a lot about flowers, shrubs, and all kinds of other garden things. So she's here today to talk about spring care for perennials. I see a lot of people in my neighborhood out doing some work and with their shrubs. We can talk about those too. And of course, you can answer any of your gardening questions, and I hope you'll join in. Maybe we can talk about pruning as well. Give us a call, a number. Ooh, I see the lines are already filled, but here's the number just one time, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Liz Freemuth, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me in. Love coming in. Love the callers. Love spring. I'm just in a happy, happy mood today.
I will probably not be in as happy a mood tomorrow because it looks like we're going to have a little snow, maybe.
And we're not going to talk about that.
We are
going to talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, daffodils and tulips. I got a whole bed full of them all flowered out right now.
Don't worry about them. Anything that comes up in the spring this early is usually pretty hardy and used to some cold blasts. If you kind of take a gander at what the averages are, and now, of course, global warming will throw those off slightly. But for us in Wisconsin, from north to south, we're looking at anything from May 17th closer to Memorial Weekend as we kind of get more northern in the state, being our last hard frost date. So we are well before that.
Yes.
And we just have had some really nice, intensely nice weather where everybody got out, got things done early, and we're expecting snow. Yeah, do we like it? Not so much. Do we have to worry about the plants? No. With a couple of provisos, and that is leave them alone. When the snow falls on those things or if it gets frosty or something, just leave them alone. Don't touch. Don't touch. Do not touch. Snow and ice provide a layer of insulation around the cells of those plants. When you touch that, you're actually forcing that plant to accept that cold, and it burns it, essentially, and then creates death in the leaves and the stems and the flowers. So just let nature do its thing. Let the snow melt. Just let things happen, and don't get too worried about it. Now, if you were one of those that got really excited and decided to put out some tomato plants or impatiens or something like that, I would suggest that you wait until the snow melts and then go out and buy new ones because there will be nothing left. Or take them in or cover them with plastic if you can. So, you know, those are your options. But we're expecting quite a substantial amount of snow. So that's going to create a lot of weight on plants that are out there. Yeah. So if they're really tender perennials / annuals, then, you know, either take them in the house if you can or just accept you're going to have to go shopping again, which for a plant person is not a bad thing.
No, never a bad thing. You know, a couple of my neighbors, I see they have little hoop house kinds of things using fabric. And I'm thinking they want to be a little careful because the weight might just create some problems.
It might if the hoops are far enough apart where that weight of the snow actually gets down.
Sags
it down, then it can. In a case like that where you've got plastic or some sort of a tarp covering hoop, then you can actually brush the snow off of that and you'll be fine. So that, you know, that's a whole nother area. And as long as there's hard structure, you can brush the snow off. But when we're talking about plant material, I would just let nature do whatever it's going to do.
You know, I mentioned daffodils earlier, and here's Karen in Peshtigo with a question about daffodils, I think. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is mostly about daffodils, a little bit about tulips. I have lived lots of different places in the Midwest, and I've never had a problem getting them to come back year after year, unless the tulips get eaten, of course. Now, here, I have very sandy soil. And my daffodils get to be smaller and smaller every year until they just don't come up again. And I've asked other gardeners in town. They've never heard of that. They don't have any problems. So I got bulb food, and I did that for a couple of years. It didn't seem to make any difference. Last year, I actually dug them all up because I was so frustrated because I've planted hundreds of them. I dug them up. I put large rocks, like large gravel, under them so that they couldn't sink down to nothing. And I put some more bulb food with them. And they're doing better, but I have some clumps that are beautiful and some that have nice, beautiful foliage, but no flowers.
And you said you're fertilizing, correct?
Yes, but I've never had to before, so that's a mystery also.
When are you fertilizing?
I think I did it in the spring and in the fall.
Okay. Typically, when I see things that are developing leaves, especially in bulbs, spring bulbs, when they're developing leaves but not developing flowers, I look at, okay, what interrupted the development of that flower bud within the bulb. And that's really what you're looking at. Number one is crowding. If you divided them up, did you separate the bulbs or did you just move clumps around?
So when I dug them up, the bulbs themselves were really small. And so then I put them back in clumps of three or five with space in between them.
Okay. And that was the right thing to do. If you dug up and you actually have smaller bulbs, that tells me over time your initial bulbs have died out and what you're looking at are actually the babies that have started developing and growing. And so the flowers are going to be a little bit smaller. And as they age, you should be doing okay. I think gravel, if you've got clay soil, if it drains well, you're okay. If you put gravel in on top of clay soil, sometimes you can create sort of a water pond effect. So you may want to check to make sure that it's drying properly under there and draining properly. And one way you can do that is actually just to get a water meter and you can poke that into the ground and you have to calibrate it and you can get them at varying depths, 12 inches. We've got some that are 24 inches and you calibrate it to a glass of water and that will give you the wet calibration and then you can stick it into the soil and it will tell you how wet it is. So that
actually
can...
I was thinking that the opposite when Karen was talking about putting the gravel in, I thought she's got a really sandy soil. So the water's going to go away a lot faster.
It will, but bulbs don't like standing water.
Yeah.
And so really getting it away is great, and that's why you want to check to make sure that you don't have standing water under the gravel. But I think you're doing all the right things to try and remediate the issue. I do find that some daffodil bulbs are not as hardy as others. When you're looking at tulips, tulips are technically biologically annuals. So oftentimes, unless you're getting species and the Darwin bulbs, et cetera, that say specifically hardy and perennial for this zone. Otherwise, often what you'll get are actually tulips off of the babies as opposed to the original bulb itself. So when you look to purchase them, you have to kind of consider that as well. But if you've been doing this for a while, you know, I'd say you're doing all the right things. Just give them a little bit of time to grow.
There you go, Karen. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, let's go to another caller here. Julie in Platteville will give you a chance now. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
I have a large yard that's on a fairly decent slope, and it's surrounded by woods, and I'm committed to... I'm not worried about the shady areas that are under the trees that aren't planted with turf. But the rest of it is a large turf area, and I'd like to get away from all of the mowing, the irrigation, the chemicals. And I'm wondering if there is a suggested alternative, maybe a ground cover. And I don't mind mowing it if necessary, you know, every so often. But I'd like to get away from all of the turf chemicals and the turf irrigation once it's established.
How large of an area are we talking about? And then also, what kind of conditions? Sunny?
It's fairly sunny. It's fairly north and west facing. So it gets I don't have the areas under trees that I'm expecting to, you know, convert mm-hmm. to this change. It's the soil is not good. It's kind of rocky clay.
Mm-hmm.
And the area is pretty big. I'm going to estimate, you know, that it's, let's say, one big central area is about 10,000 square feet. You know, it's a mm-hmm. big area.
Okay.
And I'm just, you know, I spend like $1,500 a year paying somebody to mow it.
Yeah, I hear you on that. Your initial investment to change something over from grass to whatever else you choose is going to be substantial as well. You will see the results probably within about 5 to 7 years. You'll kind of be at break even. So just expect that up front, that you are going to have some costs going into it. One alternative, if you want to do nothing, is if it's Kentucky bluegrass, you can just let it grow. And, you know, it will actually go into dormancy in July or so. It'll look kind of cruddy, and then it will revamp itself in the fall or as temperatures cool. So you could do that. There are also a number of no-mow grasses. So if you choose to stay with sort of a grass look, no-mow is fantastic. And Olbrich Botanic has a nice display of no-mow at their facility. And you're not too far away. If you get to Madison, you know, that would be something to go and look at. The other thing possibly would be to go up to Westby and take a look at some of the prairies that are done up there.
Yeah, and some beauties.
Yeah, and that may be something that you want to take a look at, because to me, I didn't hear anything definitive. You're looking to do something different. And so look at a bunch of the options first. I mean, there is Liriope or Liriope, depending on how you like to pronounce it, that should be hardy for Platteville. And that gives you a grassy look. And then you can get a little bit of a flower that pops up and you don't have to do anything with it. It's tufted. Mazes is another ground cover vinca. But, you know, for 10,000 square feet, that's an awful lot of ground cover. And anytime you put one particular planted, you've developed a monoculture, which now you're just inviting diseases and insects and problems to come in and start decimating that one particular plant. So you may trade one issue for another. And so I would actually look at diversity. I would take a look at some of the prairies that are out there. And you can go low. It doesn't have to be a high prairie. And prairies typically, if you get the right mix, will love some really kind of cruddy soil and the heat.
And there again, you're looking at some preparation.
Absolutely.
And looking at a couple of years, 3 years probably before, on a prairie situation, probably five.
Mm-hmm. It's Westby, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. They do a beautiful job, and you can walk through and take a look, and they can help you out with choosing shorter seed, shorter plants that are not going to be the 12-foot tall prairie.
Yeah, and they can establish pretty quickly. I mean, you'll have something there right away.
And you do have mowing. You know, there's probably
once or twice a year.
Yeah, to kind of keep the weeds under control, especially as it starts to thicken in. And you know, it's a wonderful thing to do. The diversity is going to be wonderful. Adding some good pollinators is a good thing too, which will come with the prairie.
Julie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Liz Freemuth, our guest today, she is the owner of the Garden Hoe. She provides concierge horticulture services through her business, the Garden Hoe. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at spring in the flower garden a little bit, talking spring perennial care. We can talk about shrubs. We talk about a whole lot of things. We just got done talking about lawns a little bit with our guest, Liz Freemuth from the Garden Hoe. Liz, what's your... You have a website? I can't remember. You always tell me.
I do, yeah. And then I always tell you I really should look at that once in a while. Yeah. It's www.thegardenhoe.com.
Yeah. And you have clients in many states, do you?
I do, yeah. And I often find the southern ones to be the most challenging, just because it's a mind it's a mind switch when I go from up here in February to Florida in February. And then it's the wheels turn a little bit slower and the sun is shining and it's warm. And I think, ooh, beach. No, work. And yeah, so that can be a little bit of a transfer. But yeah, I do like a challenge of going to some place that I need to learn.
Yeah,
about.
You it's usually bring back a plant or two from where I know you brought
I
some
do.
Back from California last year.
I do, yeah. And the last time I didn't even have to get swabbed. It was awesome. Yeah. Kind of depends on the state as to how much they let you leave with without actually having to get searched in the back room. And I'll bring orchids back from Florida because they're just, I mean, you know, just so fantastic.
Yeah.
And Georgia, I will always bring some plants back. I will test them to see if I can get them to grow outside. Because sometimes they'll put a zone on plants that you purchase, and that's the zone because that's as far as they've tested it. So on some of them, I'll look and say, you know, potentially you might live. And I've had one out of about 30 say, yes, I will, and the rest of them die. But that's okay. They lived a good life before they died.
Well, I hope Melissa in Beaver Dam doesn't have any dead plants. Let's go there. Melissa, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
So I have a question about my hydrangea that I've had for several years, but the last few years I am only getting one or two blooms, and I'm not quite sure why or what I can do to have more.
What type of a hydrangea is it?
Oh, well, that's a question I don't know the answer to.
Okay, then let's take a step back and I'll ask, are the heads round or are they shaped like cones?
They're round.
Okay. Blue, white, pink?
Well, they started pink and now they have turned more to the bluish white.
Okay, are you adding product, any kind of acidifier to the soil?
I have not. I've only done like a basic fertilizer.
Okay. What you might want to do, Beaver Dam, do you know what your soil pH is?
I don't.
Okay. And you can kind of get sort of an idea if you just look at some soil websites. You can kind of see what your soil is. But are we talking about an extensive planting or one or two?
Just one.
Okay. So you can baby this.
Yeah.
Okay. What we're looking at is you really need to lower the pH for one thing. Almost across the state, we need to lower pH for hydrangea. They like it around 5, 5.5, 6. Yes. The lower, excuse me.
Lower is better.
Lower is better, especially if you're looking for a blue color. When they're pink, you're looking at kind of a higher pH. And again, this is sort of depending on the cultivar. Some will never turn blue. Some will never turn pink. Some will only be white. So kind of trying to decide which hydrangea you have is maybe a good first step. Second step would be getting a soil test of some sort, or at least finding out what your pH is so that you know what you can and cannot add. Getting a soil test done from the soil lab will allow you to say, this is hydrangea. They'll tell you what you need to apply and in what amounts to get the pH where it's good for that plant to perform as well as it can. And, excuse me, and then really what you're looking at is the next step is, you know, get the basic health in line. But then take a look at when you're pruning, because different hydrangeas require different pruning. And identifying which hydrangea you have is going to give you a chance to actually properly prune it. If it is an hydrangea that is a terminal bloomer, it will develop buds along the stem in addition to that terminal bloom, meaning it will bloom the biggest on the end of the stem. So if you're cutting that off, that terminal bud off, at the improper time, what's going to happen is those secondary blooms are going to come out, but they're going to be smaller, and they're not going to be as lovely as what the terminal would. So finding out which type of a hydrangea you have is going to be kind of important. If it was purchased at a local garden center, you can take a leaf in and see if you can match it up, or even just go up and down the aisles of hydrangeas to see if you can find something close to what it is. And doing those things will actually get you on track to getting better blooms.
Yeah, very good advice. Melissa, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Amy is in Iola, and she has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Hi. My question is, I have a forsythia that is over 20 years old and has never been pruned. Mm-hmm. And now this is the second year that it's not flowering. It will leaf out. Mm-hmm. It's also sent up shoots that don't flower.
Yeah. Are you seeing any even small flowers at the base?
No, I see them right now, and they're way out on the tips of it. That's the only flower.
Okay, that kind of surprises me, because what we did see this year is we actually saw quite a bit of dieback on the buds for a couple of reasons. Number one, I actually saw blossoming happening on my forsythias in fall, because it had a sort of dormant period, and then it got conditions that said, hey, maybe we should flower. And some of it did, and some of it didn't. So on those, the flowering was very sporadic. This spring, it was really kind of hit or miss. On some of the larger shrubs, though, remember when we had that, 60-mile-an-hour winds, and it was 49 below zero or whatever it was that we had.
Awful.
Yeah, that hit in February. And, you know, that actually killed off a lot of blossoms. And so anything that was exposed that was above the snow line actually got nailed, and you saw little to nothing for flowering. And the other thing to consider and to really take a look at is if it has not been pruned in 20 years, it's probably starting to get a little cramped down in around the base. And so you need to go in and prune off some of those older stems, open it up a little bit, and possibly give it a dose of fertilizer. And then, you know, last year we actually had the same thing. So before you kind of think, wait a minute, that was this year that we had cold temperatures. What about last year? We had the same thing last year. It didn't affect as much as it did this year, but it is something to consider. So I would say do some cleaning out on that shrub. You might even give it another week to see if it is going to flower. If you've got a little bit on the outside edges, see if it is going to flower. If it's not, go ahead and get it cut. They bloom on old wood. So anything that blooms on old wood, you want to cut right after it blooms so that it has a chance to develop tissue and then also buds before it goes into hardening off for winter.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Amy, and those forsythias should be blooming right about now, shouldn't they?
They should, yeah.
Sure should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kathy in Dodgeville, of course, she's looking at the good weather. She emails us, and so, well, the weather's good, so I pulled back all the mulch from my strawberry beds.
Of course you did.
Now, here comes the snow for Saturday. What should she do, if anything?
The strawberry plants, you know, depending on how big the bed is, that one probably has the fruit buds set on it already. So that, I would say, maybe if you could throw something over the top, that would be one of those good exceptions to say, yeah, maybe I need to put a little straw back on it. And even just to cover each individual plant, not the whole entire bed, but just cover each little bit individual plant.
All right. That makes good sense. Let's go to Karen in Door County next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I just had a question about all the damage from this winter from ice. I planted some new shrubs last fall, mm-hmm. and I've got just a lot of broken branches, and they seem to still have green in them. They're not dead. They're just all broken, and I'm wondering, is there some way I should attack with my St. John's wort bush, and can I save these branches and potentially root them?
You can give it a whirl. Why not? They're there. And if they seem like they have life in them, I would say go ahead. Why not? See if you can get them rooted. The St. John's wort, are we talking about a fairly dense shrub?
Yeah.
Okay. They'll withstand a bit of pruning. They'll look a little spindly for a couple of years, but then they'll rebound beautifully. So I don't know that I would worry about those tremendously. And just do a nice job on the pruning, nice sharp cutting tools, and make sure if you see any kind of diseased tissue anywhere and you're cutting through it, make sure that you're disinfecting your equipment in between cuts. But otherwise, I'd say just do a nice balanced job of it. Take it down to within a quarter of an inch of a joint or where the stems come together. The St. John's wort is actually pretty tough.
Yeah.
So I think you'll be okay with that. And if you're going to try and root tissue, I would go for some of the younger tissue towards the end of the branch. That's going to give the amateur the best chance. Yeah, most definitely.
Sure. Karen, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Jude in Iola. Hi. Thanks again for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I seem to have a dilemma with my lilacs. I planted about 5 years, 5-6 years ago, two new plants, and they only get like one or two, flowers. And even with the buds on them, the ones that haven't gotten eaten up by the deer, is it because, and I do trim them back, or is it because I need to fertilize them, and what would I fertilize them with?
Trimming back, I don't like the sound of that.
No, and especially if deer are doing a number. How big were these plants when you put them in?
Let's see, I bought them at a nursery, and maybe 4 feet tall.
Okay, so right. Pretty good size. And soil-wise, lilacs will tolerate almost anything except extremely wet feet. So is your drainage okay?
Yes.
Okay. And when the deer did damage, how much did they do? Did they take it right down to the base, or did they just sort of nibble on the ends?
They nibble on the ends, but I didn't notice that they did anything this year. But last year, I used netting to cover it because I didn't want them to get out after them.
Yeah.
But I think these plants are actually 5-6 years old, and I had talked to somebody. They says maybe it's fertilizer.
Well, lilacs are pretty tough.
They're the toughest plant ever.
Between that and peonies, if you put them in right, they kind of just don't want to die. And you could do fertilizer, but fertilizing at the wrong time for anything that flowers or fruits is going to develop more vegetative growth than it is flowers and or fruit. So kind of rule of thumb, and exceptions to every rule of thumb, but kind of rule of thumb is you wait until those flowers are out, or the fruit is, the fruit flowers are out before you start adding fertilizer to anything. Generally, when plants are flowering or fruiting, they're at their weakest and they can use the fertilizer at that time. So if you feel as though you need to do that, go ahead. But you may actually want to send a soil sample up to the soil lab to see if it's fine. It may be too fertile for a lilac, and they can tell you what that level should be. As far as cutting it back, lilacs bloom on old wood. So you're good until about June-ish with pruning. If you're pruning after June, you're cutting off next year's flower buds. And when the deer are feeding, they're probably feeding on those flower buds as well. And so they may actually take those off for you. And you may not even notice. They can just kind of nibble and take those things off. Unlike rabbits, which have a very, very distinctive angled sharp cut, deer will rip. And so sometimes you don't even notice that they're taking off the blossoms. But I would say time really is important also, because things really need about 4 years after you plant them to develop and really start putting out what they're going to be doing for the future. So, they're kind of young. They're babies yet. Don't expect them to drive the car. They need to go to school and learn how to drive first. So, just maybe get the soil tested. Don't prune after June and see what happens with them.
And that pruning should be kind of at the base, shouldn't it? When you really do prune, you take the largest stems out, maybe a third of them or so?
Yes. When you're talking about shrubs, yes, multi-stem shrubs. If you've got a single stem lilac, you probably don't want to prune at the base. But I think that's called removal. But otherwise, and if you really don't want to, if you want to develop maybe 3 or 4 huge stems and then have flowers coming off of that, then you can train it to do that as well. Lilacs are so easy when they're happy. They can actually get, some soil diseases and some leaf diseases, so we can look at that stuff as well. And, those things, samples up to Brian at the lab, at the Plant Diagnostic Lab, will get you an answer on that also very inexpensively. But they do need some time. Give them a little bit of time.
Jude, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Chris and Adams a chance to join in. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a suggestion for all of the bunny deer people, which is I tell people this every year. Tabasco sauce. You have to reapply it every time it rains, but it's cheap. You put it in a spray bottle, and they will come and they will taste, but they will not come back. Honest to God. okay, you can put it on your vegetable plants. I put it on everything.
Do you see, but I have a question for you on that one, because I don't use Tabasco on my plants. So I have you, I'm going to ask you, does it burn any of the tissue or the leaves or anything?
I haven't noticed anything.
Okay.
When I first moved into this house, which is two springs ago, I put in a row of hostas, and the lady across the street said to me, I watched the deer eat all your hostas.
We call it the salad bar, yeah.
So I went out and I sprayed all the hostas with Tabasco, and the deer came and they tasted, and they have not been back because they used to roam around in my yard in the wintertime, so I would know that they were here, but they have skedaddled.
Excellent.
So,
excellent.
So, I mean, what's the difference? If the Tabasco burns your plants or the deer eat them, you're with them.
I love your attitude. Absolutely love your attitude about it.
My question.
Yep.
I have a mature maple tree in my front yard, and I'm somewhat attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 50 feet high, maybe 18 inches across. And it's not doing real well, but this is not a question about the maple. I am tearing all of the turf out of my front yard and putting in perennial bushes and other fun things for the neighbors to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And I am we don't have dirt here.
Okay.
I am digging the sand out very carefully from between the maple tree roots because they're close to the surface and I don't want to harm my maple tree.
Mm-hmm.
So I thinking, instead of doing that because it's a pain and time consuming, that I would just build some raised beds.
No.
In my
No.
My maple roots.
No. No. Don't do that.
You do that if you want to kill it.
Yeah. Happy Arbor Day, by the way. Yeah. No, don't kill the tree. You won't do it any favors. They actually, I think Laura recommends no more than 3 inches of mulch over roots as well. And
maple's about as shallow rooted as you're
exactly. Dad. And when they start reaching up, they do that coming up out of the ground. They do that because they need it. They need to add a little bit. They want the air, you know, so they're coming up for a reason. So as you're pulling that out, just put mulch down. You know, if you want something to cover, just put mulch down and it'll be fine. But no more than about 3 inches.
So there you go. Chris, thank you very much for calling.
I love the fact that she asked. You
yeah.
know,
instead
when
of
you,
just going ahead and doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, because we see that an awful lot where people put raised beds around the base thinking that they're helping the tree by, you know, reducing foot traffic on it or plants or whatever. And it really, you're not, she's absolutely right, you're not going to save your tree that way. So, yeah, put the raised bed somewhere else.
And thanks again, Chris. John in Sturgeon Bay, let's go to you. Hi, John.
Hi there. I'm going to ask a question instead of just doing it as well.
So go ahead.
We love it.
We have a really cool tamarack tree that we planted, and it was only a couple of feet high when we planted it by the edge of our pond, and now it's probably 10 or 12 feet high. But it has another little tamarack tree twisting its way up maybe 2 inches in diameter, twisting its way up around the trunk all the way up to the top. And I so much wanted to just go saw that off and untwist it, but I just am curious if that's the way to go on that.
Yeah, go ahead. Otherwise, what you're going to have, and who knows where that actually is coming from, and if you're curious, you can very gently dig around the trunk of the main tree to see if that's coming off of the roots or if it's actually a separate tree itself growing. And if it is a separate tree that, you know, that came from seed that landed there or whatever, then you might be able to dig that out and transplant that somewhere else if you so choose. But otherwise, yeah, removing suckers from trees is a good idea if you want a single stem tree. Otherwise, it can actually provide a lot of competition for the original, and it can weaken the original tree's trunk. So, yeah, it's a good idea to remove suckers if you don't want them. If you want to save it, see if you can find the root and replant it.
Go from there.
Yeah.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. And by the way, I haven't given the number in a long time. Let me do it right now. It's 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest today, Liz Freemuth, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Well, here's another question about, well, this one's about rhubarb from Margaret, who emailed, should she be protecting her rhubarb from the coming snow? She read, it's dangerous to eat rhubarb stalks if the plant has experienced freezing temperatures. Is this true?
I'm going to do a resounding, I don't know, on that one. I know that you can actually run into issues if you're eating rhubarb that has started to decompose. Now, if you leave it alone and the frost and the snow and everything dissipates and it looks good, I don't know that it's an issue, but I would double check on that one. So I'm going to do a resounding I don't know, and then I probably would call somebody on toxic plants and find out if it is.
I don't know either.
Yeah, that's not one that I've had to deal with. Typically, if you think about it, typically when rhubarb is up, we have the potential for frost and or snow anyway.
Yeah.
And I have never as a child did I die from going into the rhubarb patch, which was 10 by 20 feet, and eating it. You know, you take a little bowl of sugar out, dip the rhubarb in it and eat it, way healthy. And never had a problem no matter what the weather was. So I don't know. But because I don't know, I would say don't eat it then until we get an answer. I'll get an answer. You can put it on your Facebook page.
Yeah. We'll get something here. Yep. And somebody will probably call up.
I hope so. We know
it usually happens. A master gardener calls and says, "You dummies, whatever."
Exactly. And I might have missed that memo that came through. So, yeah. Awesome. If you know out there, call and let us know.
Dan in Edgerton, in the meantime, has a different question. So let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. So we have 4 hydrangea plants on the west side of our house, and they are endless summer.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been, not having very good luck at all with them.
Yeah.
They look burnt and small.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side of the house, on the east side, we have a different kind of hydrangea, the one with the big white bulbs.
Uh-huh. Probably an Annabelle of some sort. Yeah.
It's just huge.
Mm-hmm.
So should we move those to the other side or what?
Yeah, you aren't going to lose anything by moving them if you let them stay. I'm assuming that the west side is full sun.
Yeah.
Endless summer are beautiful plants when they love you. And they love 3 people on the planet. So they're kind of tough to actually find that perfect spot for them. And when they are perfectly happy, you will love them. Try them on the west side, see how they do.
They're already on the west side.
I mean the east side. I'm sorry. Thank you, Larry. Try them with the next to the Annabelles and see how they do. They just endless summer.
It's more like endless headache sometimes.
It's sort of like endless replacement.
Endless replacement.
Yeah, that was a good moneymaker. When they're happy, they are gorgeous. I've seen plantings of them that are phenomenal. But when they are unhappy, they make us all unhappy. So moving them, can't go wrong with them.
Go east, young man.
Go east, yes. Go east.
Larry. Oh, boy. Rebecca and Madison, we'll get to you in just a minute, but I got to remind you as you're listening in here that our guest today is Liz Freemuth. Liz provides concierge horticultural services around the country through her business. She's based right here in Wisconsin. And our business is called The Garden Hoe. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth, owner of The Garden Hoe, concierge gardening service. Great to have her with us. Certainly a questions. The number is 800-642-1234. Rebecca in Madison has a question for you, Liz. So let's go there. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm calling because I just heard you talking about a tree in a raised bed. And when I bought my house, there's a mature maple tree in the front yard, and it has like timbers. It's like maybe 12, 18 inches high kind of raised bed made out of timbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just pull those away and the tree will be fine. I don't even like the look of it. And I wonder, would I hurt the tree or all the roots and everything? Would there be like erosion or anything? Can I just pull those timbers away and just let it go naturally?
I would say yes, with a proviso that you may actually want to pull that material off of it slowly. So take the timbers off and then you know, rake a little bit of that soil out, maybe a couple inches of it, and then let it sit for a few weeks, you know, and allow those tree roots to actually get used to a change in their environment. I think overall, yes, the tree will be much happier, but I'm not sure what you're going to find underneath there. Depending on what the tree was, it may actually have sprouted some roots off of the trunk, because that can happen when they're planted too deep. So you're going to want to give that tissue a chance to actually readapt to what it will become accustomed to. And then just every few weeks, take a little bit more off. And then I think you'll do a better job of transitioning that into a more normal life for the tree.
That's great advice. But you can get rid of those timbers.
Absolutely.
Right now.
Yeah.
Pretty close to right now.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And Rebecca, thank you so much. Let me rephrase myself here. Vicki in Albany, it's your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. My husband and I just recently built a home, and we're starting fresh with all our gardens. And I'm looking for a recommendation for a climbing perennial on the west side of our garage.
Full sun?
Yes.
How much support can you give it?
We have some pretty heavy-duty trellises made out of, you know, rebar and stuff.
Okay. How far up is Albany?
We're south of Madison,
Got it.
20 miles.
Depending on what you like for look, plant itself, I mean, wisteria I have come to love because it is just tough as nails, and you can prune it to your heart's content and it comes back for more, but it does require an awful lot of support and it requires attention. It's not something that you can just put in and expect that it's going to behave, because if you put it in and ignore it, it will probably come through the walls in your living room at some point and say hello, because excuse me, It is just one of those really, really, you have to excuse me, I'm getting over walking pneumonia and have allergies. It is one of those that is a forever grower. Clematis, west side, if it's full sun, you'd have to provide an awful lot of cool cover for the root zone. Otherwise, they do like the top heat. So clematis or clematis, however you choose to pronounce it, it actually would do very well there. Also, there are some beautiful Polish varieties out there that have got lovely flowers. So you can do almost anything with flower color, shape, size, etc. Trumpet vine, if you're looking for something a little bit different, you can go orange, yellow, reddish with something like that. If you're looking for even something a little bit more unusual, I mean, you did say perennial, but I'm going to tell you my favorite love this year is loofah sponge. That actually needs a trellis to grow on.
And, it does.
And it had been years since I had grown that. And all of a sudden this year I saw loofah seed and went, oh, I've missed you. And so I've been putting that in. But for us here, those are the ones that will do about the best. Climbing hydrangea, also, I should say that. That one is one that will go slowly, and once it takes hold, it will fill beautifully. So that will also do fairly well. You will need to provide some coolness around the roots on that one also.
There you go. I was thinking about clematis when you were talking about it, because I didn't have any luck at all, and I think it was because I wasn't providing something cool, a little bit cooler conditions for the roots.
Yeah, and when you talk about using metal for a climbing area for that, sometimes, depending on what the heat is, that'll get to be a little much for anything but the most invasive. There's Summer Love, that's what it's called. Summer Love clematis that is actually an autumn clematis that will tolerate the heat a little bit more, and it's a purpley pinky color in addition to the white. So we do have some options with that as well. That's a little bit tougher.
And thanks again for calling. Tom in Windsor, it's your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I hope you haven't covered this yet. I know you have talked about daffodils, but I have some large patches of daffodils. After they're finished blossoming, can I dig them up and transplant them?
I would wait until the stems and the leaves start turning a little bit yellowy color. And they don't like to be moved right after they blossom. What you need to do is allow those stems and the leaves to pull in the carbohydrates to feed that base, the bulb, and then to start to develop the bud blossom in there. So I would give them until they start to turn yellow, then go for it. Go for it.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Liz in Dane next. Hi, Liz.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about peonies, and I apologize if you've already discussed peonies, but I have some really nice ones. They're on the southeast corner of a large stone house, and they get too much shade, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering when I can transplant them or when I can. May I put something in now, or do I have to wait until fall?
Okay, the rule of thumb for peonies is August 17th is the date, the magic date, when you can start moving peonies around. That's from a professional standpoint. From a personal standpoint, go ahead and move them now, because otherwise they might end up dying this year if they're getting too much shade or if you're unhappy with them. What you want to do is disturb the root as little as the root mass, because it's going to be a bunch of tubery looking things underneath there. And so what you want to do is disturb that mass the least amount as possible and then just transfer it over. Now, that's if you want to actually see the blossoms this year. If it doesn't make that much difference to you, you will lose part of the plant if you start dividing that out, you know, snapping off the little ends, and wherever you see an eye poking up or where there's a plant coming up now, they're up about a foot by me. You can move them almost at any time. I would do it when the temperatures are going to be a little bit cooler and when you either have access to water for them or it's going to be raining for on and off for a couple of days to get them well watered in. Peonies really do not like it if you plant them deeply. If you dig a shallow hole, put them maybe within 2 inches of the top of the soil surface, and you think, oh, that seems too shallow. It's just perfect. That's what they like. So you don't want them buried underground or they won't flower for you. They get angry and go, fine, I'll just keep it to myself. So, you know, the real answer is August 17th. But because I'm a gardener and I know I can't help playing with stuff, yes, go ahead and just expect you're going to lose some stuff.
There you go, Liz. Thank you so much for calling. Ken in Monroe, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Morning. Love the show. First time caller. My question is, I have a couple maple trees that need to be trimmed. I'm just double checking to see, would spring be good or wait till the fall?
How overgrown are these? Do they create any kind of a risk situation for anyone walking underneath them or car parked or a roof or anything like that?
Not underneath, getting close to the house, getting close to the roof.
Okay. Do you have an arborist?
I don't.
Okay, it's going to take you that long to find one. That it's like finding a doctor. You know, there's a lot of great arborists out there. You'll want to find one that you can develop a long-term relationship for, not just guy with chainsaw back of truck. You know,
A certified arborist.
And Wisconsin has a lovely list. There's also an international list, and they will tell you what their certification is in, what they specialize in, and go for a long-term plan, especially if it's a tree that you want to keep in the yard. They do provide, you know, sometimes between $4,000, $7,000, $9,000 worth of property value to your property when they're properly taking care of trees.
Yeah.
So it's worth investing in a little bit. And I love the fact that, number one, you're a first-time caller. That's absolutely awesome. Welcome.
Yeah,
welcome to the world of questioning gardening. I love it. And then go looking for an arborist, interview a few of them, get, you know, really delve into what they offer and what you're looking for, and then kind of pick and choose. And by that time, the timing will be right for it.
Yeah, there you go, Ken. Thank you so much. Chris in Appleton, have you got a quick question for us?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to plant 3 raised beds in my backyard, but the neighbor's buckthorn roots are coming into my yard right where I want to put at least 2 of those beds. Is that going to cause a problem, the roots of that buckthorn?
They may start coming up through your beds. What you might want to do is cut through those at your lot line, or maybe even talk to your neighbor. If you have a good neighbor relation, you might actually work with them to get rid of that buckthorn that's along your lot line. Again, maybe working together, because I can't imagine they're loving it. So maybe doing that will help get rid of it. But otherwise, cut down through the ground, pull them up, and you know that's about the best that you can do.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best idea. And do you know the name? Bob wondered, the scientific name for the early little blue flower that's sometimes called cilia?
Cilia. It is cilia. It is cilia. Yeah, the common name is squill.
Ah.
Yeah, it's Scilla siberica, I believe. Otherwise, it's called Siberian squill.
Siberian squill.
Is the common name.
You know everything, don't you?
I pull it out of the gray matter. Nope, not by a long shot, but I do try.
Oh, man. Liz Freemuth, our guest today. She provides concierge horticultural services through her business, and her business is called The Garden Hoe, and you can go to her website. It's called thegardenhoe.com, thegardenhoe.com. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we visit with Liz Freemuth, who provides concierge horticultural services through her business. It's called The Garden Hoe, and you can find her website at thegardenhoe.com. Always great to have her along. You know, we started the show by talking about the snow and the terrible weather, and Sherry just emailed to ask if she could could she pick her tulips and daffodils before, or should she pick them before they get hit by the snow?
I did, but then again, I go out and I pick all of that stuff anyway, so I have vases full of hyacinth and daffodils and tulips in the house, because you know why else would I grow them other than to enjoy them? If you think that they will be done by the time the snow melts, I would say, yeah, sure, go out and pick them. Why not?
Yeah,
I would just keep them separate. You don't put tulips and daffodils together in the same vase. Daffodils actually exude something out of their stems that will lessen the beauty of the tulips and actually kind of sort of make them wither a little bit. They don't respond as well. So put them in separate vases.
Well, you are the smart one. I just learned something else here today, and as I always do every week on Garden Talk. But I did not know that.
You know, the spinning brain, every once in a while, we love it when it's something pops out that's useful, because sometimes it just keeps spinning and nothing pops out, definitely.
Oh, boy. Well, let's take some more calls. Judy in Green Bay will go to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my phone call. I have a crabapple tree in my front yard that is about 10 years old. And last fall, a little buck rubbed the velvet off his stubby little antlers on one side of the tree and took all the bark off.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrapped it in burlap and tied it with string. Mm-hmm. And the leaves are starting to come out on the tree. It's looking good. But I want to know, do I leave that burlap on or do I take it off?
Take it off. Let the tissue dry out and let it kind of, it's not going to heal over, but it'll close over. You won't see that bark come together, but you'll see it sort of, we can compare it to a scab kind of thing. You won't see anything other than dry off, and hopefully they won't bother it. What I might do is put a protectant on it for next time rub season comes, because if they were there rubbing once, they may come back again. They're creatures of habit, and so you want to prevent them from doing any more damage on it. oftentimes a tree will do okay if just one side of it or part of one side is rubbed off. It's when the bark is girdled all the way around the circumference of the tree that you have to worry about it cutting off flow of water and nutrients up and down the trunk. So I would say take it off, let it dry out, and, you know, just let it see what it's going to do. You may see a little bit of dead branches showing up here and there as a response, but just trim those back and you should be fine.
Yeah. I'd take that burlap off right away.
I would too.
Yeah.
Burlap does serve some purposes, but during the winter and during kind of dry periods when the tree is not active, it can actually pull moisture out of a plant.
Yeah.
And so it wicks like, you know, anything else would wick. So getting it off now would be a good thing.
Thanks, Judy. Appreciate it. Kevin in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon. I have a nice bur oak in this property I just bought. It's probably 12 inches around, probably 18, 20 foot tall. And within 6 foot of it, there's a small bur oak about 7 foot tall that's come up.
Mm-hmm.
And again, about another 6 foot away is another bur oak that's about 10 foot tall. Can I move those two little ones? Can I spade those or will I kill them doing that?
Oh, you know, if you don't know what you're doing with digging up oak trees, it's possible that you will kill them. If it's something that you really want to have moved properly, I would actually call a nursery in your area. Where are you? Madison. Yeah, call a good nursery, a good tree nursery in the area, and see if you can get somebody to come out and dig those for you. Oftentimes what they will do, if they can get in between the trees and get access, is use a tree spade to pull them up and replant them for you. And you actually do get really good results doing that. That can cost you a little bit. But if these are trees that you want to keep, it may be worth it for you. You know, if you're willing to just roll the die and say what happens, happens, go ahead and give it a whirl. But what you're looking at is going down really quite deep to get as much of that root as possible. So that's where...
And then you're looking at potentially harming the big tree that you were trying to save.
Exactly.
And you are, if it's only 5 feet away, you are going to be injuring the roots of that other tree.
You will definitely be injuring them. And so that's where, if you do want to do it, bring in a professional who's going to know how to lessen that injury to the most benefit of those plants.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Jill in Racine next. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Liz and Larry. Will absolutely anything grow under, I know it's the roots because the person who answered the phone said it's the roots, grow under a black walnut? She said lilac. Is there anything else that will grow under that?
There are actually quite a few things that will grow under black walnut. And with black walnut, it's every single part of that tree. Is you can get some effect from juglone off of it.
Even the leaves.
Even the water coming off of the leaves. In the rain, you can get issues. So it's every single part. But having those roots underneath really does impact it a lot. Lilacs, yes, I have had some luck with some weird kind of roses. But for the most part, in my experience, even with a butternut tree, which has a lesser degree of that in its system, I have had shrubby roses that sucker up, and the suckers will move further and further away from the tree. It doesn't grow toward the tree. It grows away from it. Raspberries will grow underneath it. Gooseberries, I think, will grow. It's been a while since I've looked at my list, and I have a list that I've put together from a number of different areas around the country with similar conditions to ours. And so there are quite a few things. It's just a matter of picking out the right ones. Typically, if you're looking at something, a developed cultivar is a little bit weaker than a species plant. So peonies, sometimes I have really good luck with those weird old kind of
the old timers,
they'll do okay within the drip line of it, but they don't particularly like it.
And if you're getting out away from the tree, I mean, those roots go beyond the
1.5 times the height of the tree.
Yeah, 1.5 times the height of the tree. And if you need something away, a little away, and you know, raised beds aren't the end of the world if you put something underneath to.
Yeah, you
keep it from coming up.
Yeah, it that and you have to worry about the wash off of the tree.
Yes.
So you kind of you're going in the right direction with what will cohabitate nicely with the black walnut. I do believe that Extension does have a list out there of trees, and it might be on Brian's website. He often has a lot of stuff on that, so it's. The Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic website, it's PDD something, whatever. If you put in Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, it'll pull up. And then just go through the sheets that he has on there for free, information sheets, and there should be one on there that helps you choose plants for black walnut.
The other option is the UW Extension Learning Store.
Exactly. Yep.
So Learning Store... Just put in UW Learning Store mm-hmm. and it'll pop up and you can find it.
Yeah, and if you're looking, if you're savvy online and you want to take a look at other areas, Rutgers has a nice list. West Virginia does. Their soils are similar, but you have to watch the zone of the plants because they're a bit warmer than we are. Also, Cornell has a decent site that lists out plants. And again, you know, UW-Madison has them as well. Purdue, I believe, also has a decent list out there.
So there you go, Jill. Thank you for calling. Pat in Heartland, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I have a question about a tree. It was probably the best tree we had on our lot, a 25-year-old Redmond Linden that was beautiful. Mm. But the last 5 years, we had a lot of trouble with Japanese beetles just defoliating it.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of summer, it looked awful.
Mm-hmm.
And then last summer, a really bad storm just kind of corkscrewed the whole huge tree right out of the ground.
Wow.
So we're looking at replacing it. And I loved the linden when it was healthy. Are some mm-hmm. of the new varieties of linden that claim to be Japanese beetle resistant, can I rely on maybe trying one of those?
Resistant does mean resistant, and each site is going to present different conditions that either raise or lower that resistance factor or leave it as is. And resistance, again, is only resistance. It doesn't eliminate it, but you can actually treat the tree for Japanese beetle. You can use a systemic, or you can have someone come in and spray the leaves early, you know, before the Japanese beetles emerge, and that will actually help an awful lot to keep them away. And I'm sure your bug guy has talked about the life cycle of the Japanese beetle, where, you know, really you're looking at about a 7-year incline, and then it drops off a little bit, and it sort of
comes and goes a little bit.
Yeah, and it sort of evens out to a little bit lower level than your highest intensity level. And so you may get a little bit of relief in there. But if it's a tree that you love, you know, it might be worth it to actually treat for a little bit. And they're not going to go away. The Japanese beetles are here. They're not going to go away.
But I will say, you know, our grapevines were denuded about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And last year I didn't see any.
It comes and goes. You know, and we had a horrible Japanese beetle population about... Ooh, gosh, it's been about 15, 16 years already, and it lasted for, like was predicted, about 7 years. Golf courses had a huge issue. Everything was totally denuded, and it kind of went back to sort of a manageable level at this point. That's not the best news, but that's what we got.
There you go, Pat. Thank you so much for calling. Well, Sandy in Iron County, it's your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
I have two lines about 10 feet long, 4 inches wide, crammed pretty good with daylilies. Now, up here, they haven't come up yet, no green growth at all. So is it okay to separate them if they're a little too crowded?
Are they all one type, or do you have a number of different types?
They're all one type.
Is it the orange, yellow? What kind do you have?
I have orange.
So kind of the ditch lily?
Well, I did buy them in the store, so I don't know if they're...
Oh, okay. So you're talking about one that has a little bit more breeding into it, but is still orange?
Yeah.
Okay. A larger flower head on it?
Very large, yeah.
Okay. Then I would say you could actually... You can do it now. Daylilies are pretty tough. You will lose some of the blossoms if you divide them by fan. So if you take each fan apart, that's going to create enough pressure on that where you may actually lose some of the blossoms this year. But it comes down to when do you have time to do it. The daylilies will respond no matter what you do. And, you know, in 2 years, you aren't even going to be able to notice that you divided them out. And so it really depends on what your acceptable loss is. If you don't want to lose any of the blossoms at all and you can afford to wait until July or so, July or August, then you do it after they bloom. And then you really see virtually, I'm going to say like maybe 90% are going to stay. The blossoms will stay from year to year if you do that. If you do it now, you might lose between 50 and 60% for this year. And then next year, you'll probably be fine. But
you'll be all right.
Yeah. If they've been in and they've been very thick, you may actually have to cut them apart as opposed to pulling them. Otherwise, when you pull them out of the ground, you'll see that you can tease them apart and tease with muscles. You can pull them apart and the fans will come apart and the roots will sort of come apart and you can plant each fan separately.
Got a nice daylily bed in the front of the house that I got from the Daylily Society when they had their annual sale. And then I tried a couple of their giants. And those things get 6 feet tall.
Don't you love them?
They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. This big yellow flower, but they're...
Are they late? Later?
Tall as I am.
Are they later in the season?
Yeah,
or are they,
a little later.
Are they scented?
Those are not.
Okay. There is one that's scented that's a tall yellow. And then there's also one that's called Autumn Minaret that has a little bit of orange and yellow on it that's tall as well and is one of the later ones in the season. And, you know, daylilies are one of those happy plants. Like this time of the year, plants want to live.
Yeah.
You know, July, they want to die. This time of the year, they want to live. And so that's kind of what makes it fun to get out and start playing around right now.
Thanks again, Sandy. Patricia in Spring Green, it's your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I bought an acreage after 27 years of living in the big city. I'm back in Wisconsin. And three of the favorite species that I dreamed of having were peonies, rhubarb, and lilac. My aunt gave me a lilac bush, but I'm wondering what type of peonies and rhubarb to buy and any tips on where to plant them.
I would say whichever type you want, as long as it's hardy for this area. There are an awful lot of beautiful, beautiful peony breeders out there who are doing wonderful job on upright, scented, you know, double balm, singles, small rock garden peonies. And all of them are fantastic. I love peonies. So even if they fall over in the rain, I still love them. They're just wonderful. It's one of those happy plants. And by the way, welcome home.
Yeah.
It feels good to be home, I'm sure. Rhubarb, I'm trying to think the last time I bought rhubarb, it was a Canadian red, I think. And that was a good one. It actually performed very, very well. And it really depends on what you want to do with the rhubarb as to what type you want. But I would hesitate ordering anything online unless you know what the hardiness is of the rhubarb, because we do have rhubarb that is not hardy, a cold hardy for us, even though it does love, most of it loves cold.
Or you can do like I do and find some friends who have rhubarb that's growing well and dig a little of theirs out and put it in yours.
Well, and she's close. She's in Spring Green, so she's close to not too far away from Randolph. Well, it's a drivable distance, or Madison. Yeah. That Jung's right now has got their bare root out. And I know that they do carry rhubarb when they have, I mean, this is the time of year when we're all buying bare root and getting it in the ground. So you may want to check that. Check your local garden center also. They may have plants that are already started. There's a wonderful place. Let's see, Spring Green, New Glarus. How far are you from New Glarus? There's a great, great plant place called Brenda's Blumenladen in New Glarus, which is just a fun place to go to. So there's lots of potential around in the area for you to find stuff that may even at this point be coming up and out of the pot. But Canadian red worked really well. Peonies, pick and choose. I actually do like the tree peonies, they're plenty hardy for us, so don't get scared off by the fact that it's tree peony. It becomes a beautiful shrub with huge blossoms on it and will actually tolerate a bit of shade. So if you don't have full sun, that can be an option. The itos, the same thing. They typically die back over the winter, although you can see a little bit of growth on the sides if it survives okay over winter. But those will come back every year as well. So yeah, lots to choose from.
Well, you pick three plants that will the right.
Oh, they love it.
They'll all love it. And who wouldn't love living in Spring Green or in that area?
Wisconsin in general.
Patricia, welcome back. Thanks so much for calling today. Good luck with that. Give us a call back sometime and let us know how that all goes. Love to hear from that. Well, Tom in Wanakee may have something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. Say, first of all, she doesn't have to go all the way to Randolph. Young's has a couple or three stores in Madison, one on Northport, one right by the airport, and one down on Nesbitt Road. Yep. And I was just over there the other day, and the bare roots are in.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
Yep, I was there myself last week. Yes, indeed they are.
I have a question about doing a little bit of ground cover around my 25-year-old greenspire lindens. My arborist called them basswoods, but the roots are up, and you know they're kind of the ground is kind of rough around there. If I try and grow grass, it'll grow, but if I mow it, I'm probably annihilating the tree. So I wanted to just cover with some ground cover. I guess it would be shallow planting, and I was at Young's and got some ideas on. They gave me ideas of Thorndale ivory, some light mulch, but silver nettle, dead nettle, Sherwood purple.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay to do? Because I see people mound up about 12 inches high stuff around the base.
I know.
Well, the city does it. That's crazy.
Yeah. No, they think volcano. They should be thinking little tiny flat donuts. In my opinion, just mulch around the base of a tree is really all you need, because anything you put on there that has roots and is going to be sucking up nutrients and water is competing with the roots of those trees. And feeder roots are within 12 to 18 inches of the soil level. So anytime you put something down, it's going to compete with the tree.
And the tree will compete with it.
Exactly. Yes. So you have warring factions there. I would just put mulch down and call it a job, quite frankly. No more than 2 to 3 inches.
Jason emailed that his ferns are a foot high. Do you think he should cover them with a bucket? He's worried about that snow.
I wouldn't. They're ferns. They're ferns. You know, and unless they were a horribly expensive specialty from the east, the far east, I don't know that I would bother with it. They probably will respond just fine. If you are concerned about it, sure, go ahead, put buckets over it. But, you know, sometimes we as gardeners tend to make more work for ourselves than we really need. But that's up to you. And that's between you, your bucket, and your ferns.
Month from now, Jason, you won't even know the difference.
That's right.
Well, Liz, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I know you're getting into the busy, busy season for you.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
I absolutely love it.
At least here in Wisconsin, busy season.
Yeah, it's been busy all year. But yes, and I hope everybody has a really wonderful Arbor Day and a great spring.
Liz Freemuth, our guest today. She provides concierge horticultural services pretty much throughout the country, but she's from Wisconsin. She specializes a little bit in Wisconsin as well, so it's always fun to have her along. Her website, thegardenhole.com. Next weekend, Garden Talk, Susan Carpenter from the UW Arboretum will be back with us, so we'll talk about what's going on over there. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.